This episode is brought to you by Shieldmaid MX, a brand new arcade-style shoot-'em-up from Hit P Studio. Adding a new twist to classic shoot-'em-ups such as Gradius and R-Type, in Shieldmaid MX you absorb enemy bullets to power up your ship and rack up high scores. Featuring a fantastic soundtrack and frenetic gameplay, Shieldmaid MX is out now on Steam and coming to consoles later in 2023.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin. Each episode, I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them that it caused them to fail their exams. Or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a breakup. Games, like songs, often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they can become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, on My Perfect Console. My guest today is a Scottish musician, producer and pop star. In 2003, while studying at the University of Strathclyde in Scotland, he met Martin Doherty, who asked my guest to produce a record for his band. The two remained friends and later joined the post-rock group Areogram. In 2007, after Areogram disbanded, my guest bought himself an analogue synthesizer. And 4 years later, he and Doherty joined up with the music journalist and singer Lauren Mabry to form the synth pop group Churches. After gaining word-of-mouth attention online, Churches released their debut single, which broke into the UK singles chart. Since then, the band have toured the world, played to millions, released 4 studio albums, and in 2019 provided a song for Death Stranding, Hideo Kojima's game about a post-apocalyptic delivery man. Welcome, Ian Cook.
Simon, sorry. I didn't meet Martin until a lot later.
Okay, so this is good. Let's live fact check this.
Okay. So yeah, Areogram, he sort of joined right at the end.
Right,
After we'd been going for about 7 or 8 years. But no, it was my friend Craig and Campbell who started Areogram, and then they had Martin Scott on drums, and then they asked me to join, and that's where all that stuff started up. And then, there was like a decade of touring and making music. But so after that, everything else was correct, but just setting the record straight on that. Fact check.
So you didn't meet Martin at uni? That came after,
I did meet Martin at uni, yes.
Okay.
I sort of finished uni and then went on tour with Areogram for most of the sort of early noughties. Mm-hmm. up to, I think the band sort of quit in 2007, but I met Martin at uni. He was there as a student in 2000, and I think we met in 2005, and I was sort of back at uni doing a master's degree and teaching there.
Oh, okay.
And so he was one of the students, and we became really good pals, nice. And I started producing stuff for his band at the time.
Yeah.
And we really hit it off creatively and ended up, you know, we were making the last Aerogram record, which was called My Heart Is a Wish That You Would Not Go.
Yep.
And we got Martin in the studio to help out with sort of like engineering and arrangements, and he became like a really important part of the group and toured with us as well on the last album tour. And on that sort of last tour, when everything was kind of falling apart, Martin and I sat down and we're like, let's do something new, something of our own. And kind of, you know, Aerogram was the sort of band where beardy men went and sort of, you know, stroked their beards. And
I was at your last gig, actually.
You were our last gig?
I was. I didn't have a beard at the time, but I might as well have, yeah.
and eventually, yeah, it was 4 years later, we met up. I'd bought the synthesizer that I bought, and then we started putting together a kind of, almost like a kind of synthy, shoegazy thing. And I was producing Lauren's band at the time, Blue Sky Archives, who's the singer of Churches. And I'd played a demo to Martin, and he was like, oh my God, her voice is amazing. Maybe we should get her in to do some backing vocals. And so we had like four or five songs, and we were recording her backing vocals, and I sort of muted the lead, which was Martin singing at the time. And it was one of those moments where, you know, you're just like, oh shit, that's the sound, you know, that's the sound.
How did Martin take it when you... I mean, he was, I guess at that point, like the lead singer.
He was the lead singer.
When you muted his track and were like, oh, hang on, this sounds like what we should be doing. Did he take that well?
Well, we both sort of realised at the same time, while she was actually recording the vocals, we sort of looked at each other with our, you know, eyes wide open.
Right, and yeah.
Okay, this is the thing. And then it just kind of grew arms and legs from there, and we went sort of full force.
Okay, listen, we'll get into some of that those days a little bit later. Firstly, let me just say thanks so much for doing this, because I know you've just been away on holiday and you just got back last night and you're super jet lagged. So thank you.
A little woozy, let's say, but you're very welcome. It's great to be here. I've been really enjoying the podcast so far. I just listened to Dara's one this morning, so it's lovely.
Oh, thanks, man. Do you find that you're jet lagged most of the time?
A great question, and the answer would be yes. Yeah, it actually seems to get worse the older I get as well. Like,
right,
you think
yeah.
it's one of these things that you can kind of get used to and take it in your stride. But we were in Australia just after Christmas there, and for like 2 weeks, I just felt like death. You know, it was the worst feeling ever. Never left the hotel really, other than when I absolutely had to for a gig or whatever. But yeah, there's no easy way around it. I've tried everything. You know, people say, okay, don't eat on the plane. You know, eat when you're hungry, sleep when you're tired and all that. And, you know, get up in the morning and exercise and get a certain amount of sunlight in the, you know, whenever. It's just like, nope, none of it works. It's all awful.
Yeah. It's almost like human beings weren't designed to whiz around
That's
the planet.
That's it. Exactly. It totally fucks your whole biorhythms and, you know, all of those kind of cycles just completely turned upside down. And it's just part of the job, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. And you recently were in Tokyo, because you sent me some pics of you hanging out with Kojima. How was that? How was the new... Because I think when you were there, they just finished their new offices. What did it look like?
Fantastic, yeah. It's the whole floor that the Kojima Productions are on now. I think they moved up a floor, is that right? One or two floors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But oh, it's amazing. I dread to think how much money they spend on doing that place up. It's almost, there's a whole section of it which is almost like a Hideo Kojima museum now, and then he's just got like glass cases with all sorts of signed memorabilia. And
that seems on brand for him.
Definitely. One of the things I love most about him, though, is he's a fan. He's a nerd, you know, just like we are. And it's just great to sit with him and talk about what movies he's seen. We rarely talk about video games, actually. It's mostly movies, and he's such a movie guy. And our tastes are actually quite similar. Yeah. But he's a lovely man. He's always, him and his team always look after us very well when we're in Japan. So yeah. You've met him, haven't you? You've met him a few times.
Yeah, I think I was there probably a couple of months before you, while they were still finishing it. So But yeah, you know, exactly as you say, he's pretty nerdy. Anyone who follows him on Twitter knows that he's constantly posting about whatever he's done. But
absolutely, yeah, it's quite funny.
It was very sweet. He had a copy of my book then when I went to see him, and it was like, that was, it was really thoughtful, like things like that, you know, just like you say, a little bit supportive, even though.
Yeah, but he makes you feel like, I guess when you've been to Japan, probably tons more than I have, but it just makes you feel like you're at home and you're welcome, you know, when you have somebody like that, that really goes out of their way to make you feel, you know, at ease and at home. It's a lovely experience.
Yeah, nice. Okay, so the format of the podcast is I'm asking you to pick your five video games you're going to put on this games machine and market to the world. Yeah, just tell us about how you went about picking your choices, and then also what your first one is.
Well, you asked me a month or so ago, and I've been thinking about it in the background constantly because, you know, it's a very serious thing to be asked, isn't it? Because I guess the answer to these questions says a lot about you as a gamer. And I want to properly represent myself and my taste. So I've been making lists and lists of like, you know, going through chronologically all of the consoles and computers and things that I've owned, and like making a list of the games that kind of hit me the hardest and that I've loved the most over the years. I think since I started making the list, I kind of picked a five just off the top of my head. And even though I went through and listed everything, that was... the list really didn't change. It was the same pretty much, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, as I said to you, like I was hoping to have some slightly weirder choices, but it turns out that, well, I don't know. I won't spoil anything at this point, but...
it's all Super Mario games.
Totally. No. but the first game that... that I chose is a game, is a shoot-em-up game, or a shmup as some people like to call them. And it's made by a company called Cave. It's called Dodonpachi Daioju. I don't know if that's how to pronounce it.
I think so, yeah.
Is it? Okay. And that, I've chose that one particularly. I mean, this is kind of representative of a love that I've had since, I guess, probably Space Invaders in the late 70s, early 80s, where of shoot-em-up games. It's always kind of been my go-to genre, I guess, out of them all. And the funny thing is I'm actually not that good at them. Actually quite bad. But it hasn't seemed to have deterred my passion for them. And I mean, I think out of all of the, if you were to look at my YouTube history, I think most of it is kind of like about shoot-em-ups and like super plays and stuff like that. And this is the year that I've decided finally to stick with one game and really get good at it. And I'm making slow progress so far, but... And I'm not making excuses about, you know, being older and having bad reaction times and all that, but emulation is a bit of a dirty word. And I do actually have the arcade board, well, the PGS cartridge.
I can see it's on behind you right now.
It is. I was playing a little before you came on. So I've been using sort of like the Steam Deck and emulation and save states for the first time, trying to sort of like replay certain parts of each of the levels and get used to the patterns and really just get, you know, get better at it, I suppose. Get good, finally, at this game. And this is the one I've chosen to work on this year, and it's been going okay so far.
Yeah, it's a Stone Cold classic. And I mean, so for anyone who doesn't know, Cave makes these, I suppose, like, you know, Cave shoot 'em ups are to Space Invaders what human beings are to single cell organisms or something.
That's
like
an
that.
Interesting analogy.
It's like the very it's just like the very end part of the evolutionary stage. Or, you know, it's all about, you control a spaceship and you're dodging incoming bullets, but that makes it sound, that reduces it from what it really is. I mean, these are, for people who know, if you know, you know, when it comes to Cave games, right? It's a small community, but, you know, I think they're some of the best games ever made.
I think so.
Just incredible, aren't they? And the one you've picked is... is widely considered, you know, one of, if not the best of the Dodon Patch games.
I did mispronounce it. Okay. Dodon Patch. Okay.
Well, I don't know that. I only pronounce it like that because, like, in the Saturn version, there's like a guy that goes, Dodon Patch. But I mean, I don't know if it's meant to be onomatopoeia like that or whatever. But
I like it. Anyway. Yeah, and I guess on the surface, you would call them a sort of subset of shmups. You would call them bullet hell games, I guess, in reference to the sort of wave of, like, you know, incredibly complicated bullet patterns. And but beyond that, the thing that marks them apart from one another, I guess, is the systems at play, the scoring systems and the chaining systems and the hyper systems, the bombing systems, and they all have quite subtle variances in those systems that make them really different to play, even though to, like, you know, an outsider, I guess, would look at them and say, oh, well, it's just, you know, dodging bullets and shooting and blowing things up. But as you know, there's a lot more going on. And yeah, this is the one that I've chosen. I was between that and Ketsui, which is another, as you say, stone cold classic and regarded as one of the best. But I think this is the one I'm finally gonna, one CC to use another term, like one credit, like no continues, you know, but I haven't done it yet.
They just announced, not a remaster, but they're bringing it out again, aren't they, for PlayStation 5, I think.
And they are, yes.
M2 doing it.
M2 with short triggers, yeah.
They're the ones, aren't they, that do such fantastic updates of arcade classics.
Yeah, and the great thing about them is they have these mechanisms in place, like the training modes and stuff, where you can replay certain bits of each stage and really get them under your fingers. Which we didn't really have the luxury of when we were growing up, I guess, importing, you know, like, I guess I played a lot of import shmups on Xbox 360 and PS2, which these discs go for a lot of money now, I guess. Yeah. They did at the time, but even more so now.
Yeah.
But they didn't really have any bells and whistles like that I'm aware of, you know. It was just kind of like pretty much straight ports of the arcade games.
Yep.
But I'm looking forward to that reissue, because then I'll be able to sort of do it on the go a bit more readily.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, like you say, you can just like pick out like a 10-second section of a level, can't you? Just play it on repeat.
It's the only way.
Until you like learn it like a like a piece of complicated classical piano music or something, isn't it?
You're right, though. It's like learning a piece of music, isn't it? There's so much involved in terms of memorization. And also, I don't know, are you aware of this guy, Mark MSX on YouTube? Yeah. He has this channel called The Electric Underground. He's a sort of young guy, very enthusiastic, very literate in the genre.
Yeah, I like his videos. Really good.
Yeah, he's great. And he's also really encouraged, given me a lot of, not personal encouragement, but through his videos, about how to get better, and, you know, things that you kind of do intuitively, like ways to sort of draw fire to a particular side of the screen or area of the screen that create sort of gaps for you to work through complicated bullet patterns, and consolidating things that I've sort of known for years but haven't really ever become part of my technique. You know, shout out to him. He's an amazing inspiration and also a really great sort of figure for the community, even though it's still quite a niche, you know, genre. I think he's bringing in a lot of new younger players.
And there's been a bit of a revival on the Nintendo Switch, isn't there, of lots and lots of you know, old shoot 'em ups coming out for the Switch, but also some new ones,
indie ones
as well.
Yeah,
some
yeah.
great ones.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. It's weirdly a really good time for to be a fan or to get into shmups for the first time if you haven't tried them.
Yeah, definitely. So tell me about what you were into when you were a kid. You grew up in Whitburn, is that right? Which is sort of in between Glasgow and Edinburgh. Have I said that right?
No, you have, totally. No, it's called, oh, it's pronounced, no, it's your Whitburn, you're right.
it's pronounced Dodon Patch.
Exactly. That's where I grew up pretty much my whole life until I sort of moved to Glasgow in the early 2000s. I think I moved to Glasgow and I've sort of been in Glasgow ever since, other than I spent like a year and a half in New York and moved back to Glasgow again. But it keeps pulling me back, Simon. It keeps pulling me back. But Whitburn is like a mining town in between Edinburgh and Glasgow. Like my granddad was a coal miner and stuff like that. And
oh, right.
Mm-hmm. It's weirdly one of these towns which, like Whitburn and the surrounding towns of, you know, like in a sort of 2 mile radius, have so many sort of musical people. Louis Capaldi is from Whitburn. These guys that just had a number one LS system with Afraid to Feel, they're from just a mile up the road in Longridge.
Really?
Susan Boyle from Blackburn, two miles along.
Wow.
The guy who's the head of Fender worldwide, I think, is from Whitburn. There's just like all
no
these
way.
People. This tiny little...
Something in the water.
Tiny little town, must be. Lead, probably. A high content of lead in the water. It's a very acute form of brain damage that applies specifically to musical ability. I don't know what it is, but... I'm grateful of it anyway.
Yeah, right. And what did so your grandfather was a miner. What did your dad do? Was there work around there?
My dad was a social worker when I was born, and then he ended up being running a bunch of sports shops, which is he was really into football and stuff, and it's kind of the reason why I absolutely detest football with a passion. My mum was a school teacher. But they were both very musical. My dad, as a kind of weekend job while he was a social worker, used to be a sort of touring musician with a Scottish country dance band called the Tartan Lads, which is probably one of the best names for a Scottish band.
Yeah.
You know, if we didn't go with churches, we might have gone with something along those lines. I don't know.
Sounds like a pub that only appears during the Edinburgh Festival.
Yeah, totally. The Brigadoon of pubs.
Yeah. Amazing. And so were they happy for you to get involved in games? Did they buy you a system and all of that stuff?
I think they were pretty... I don't think that they really paid much attention. They,
right.
I feel like... I was going to say that my first sort of home computer system was the ZX Spectrum in 1983. I think I got it. It came out in 82. I got it in 83, but actually before that there was a, you know, I don't know if you remember these little Binatone systems plugged straight into the TV, and they had a couple of paddles, and they had, you know, they were like Pong, and it was different versions of tennis, different versions of Pong. It was really, really basic. And that, you know, that was kind of a novelty. It didn't really hook me in that much, but a friend of my family's had a guy called Cliff had a ZX Spectrum, and I think the first game I saw him play was like Horace Goes Skiing, which was kind of started off, the first level was a bit like Frogger, and then it flipped to like a slalom thing where you would sort of come down the screen, and then you would get this, go back to the ski shop, and you'd go up and try and cross the road again to get to the ski slopes, and it's, you know, just a kind of two level arcade game. I mean, it wasn't the greatest, but... And then he had a Pac-Man clone called Hungry Horace. And he also had a game called 3D Ant Attack. I don't know if you remember
that.
It's a kind of isometric... I mean, to call it 3D was a bit of a stretch, but I guess it was in a sense, because there was a bit of depth to the gameplay and you could hide behind walls, and that was cool. But that was when my passion for video games really ignited, I think, when I got that. Because I played it around a house, and then I was like, Mum and Dad, you need to get me this computer. And they were like, oh, it's a bit expensive. And I was like, please. And I knew that they got it because they gave me the manual sort of in sort of September 1983. And I remember just like reading it and trying to learn BASIC so I could, you know, do some programming. And
wow.
Basically, I was just using it to sequence like happy birthday with beep commands, you know.
Oh, like that's so
10,
cool.
Beep 30, comma. And it was like you would put in, beep was the command for making a sound. And then you had like, integer that was like the pitch, and then one that was the duration.
Right,
and,
right.
And so every line was like a new beep command, and the Spectrum was like a monophonic, like it just had a tiny little tinny speaker, and it was just like one sound at a time. But yeah, that was my first real sort of passion, and I became obsessed with it.
Did you do any composition on there, or was it just happy birthday and then you moved on?
It was a bit of a cumbersome way of making music.
Sure.
But it wasn't until, there was a few years into the life cycle of the machine, I think it was about 85, they brought out a video game, a program called Wham Music Box. You know, the band Wham with George Michael, and it was the first time that I'd heard the Spectrum attempt any kind of polyphonic sound. And it did it by sort of interpolating beep commands super fast. So it sounded like it was playing a chord,
but it wasn't
playing a chord. And this actually had like a score, like a musical, you know, stave where you could, you know, it was like a visual interface. You could drag and drop notes. I did a bunch of stuff on that, but it was still a terrible first sequencer. You know?
You can only do one note at a time. That's a severe limitation.
Very much so. But it was cool because it came preloaded with all of the Wham hits like Club Tropicana and stuff like that. They were so bad, but at the time it was like, oh my God, this thing can play chords, you know?
Okay, should we come to your second game, which I think is from 2008. Can you tell us about this and when you first played it?
Well, this game is Street Fighter 4. But really, I think it goes back to Street Fighter, Street Fighter 2 on Super Nintendo. Street Fighter 2 Turbo. Was it called Super Street Fighter 2? I can't remember. Anyway.
Oh, there were so many,
and they were all like Championship Edition, Tournament Edition, you know.
Yeah.
And I think maybe I played the arcade a bunch, certainly, before I had the home console version. But when I got I was quite late getting a Super Nintendo. It was sort of right at the end of the life cycle of the machine before they started talking about the Nintendo 64. But I was quite late to the party. I'd sort of fallen off video games a little bit before that, just because I was really into sort of playing guitar and then sort of playing in bands. Yep. And then discovered women and or girls, I guess, at the time. But this is sort of what drew me back. You know, it was like a Secret of Mana, Chrono Trigger.
Oh, wow, okay.
Getting into the Japanese RPG side of things. Import games, yeah. It came bundled with Street Fighter 2 Turbo, and I just played that to death. I absolutely fell in love with it. It's a great version of the game. And I've played pretty much every version of Street Fighter on every console, apart from really the first one. I never really played the first Street Fighter very much.
It was a different beast, wasn't it?
Very different, yeah. But you mentioned my arcade cabinet before, and I imported the Street Fighter 3 Third Strike board at the time, which cost an arm and a leg. I didn't have very much money. I was like, I need to have this. But really, it was when Street Fighter 4 came out for the Xbox 360. I just threw myself back into it again, and I think it was probably the first Street Fighter game I got anywhere near good at. I thought I was, obviously, as you do, playing against your friends, you think that you're probably a lot better than you are. And that's something that changes when you start playing online and get absolutely trounced. And you're like, yeah. Oh, I'm really bad at this. And I could never really break through that ceiling. Like I was, you know, I think it takes the kind of dedication that I really didn't have the patience for. I had lots of time, but not really the patience for it, for that sort of level of persistent humiliation.
Yeah, in a way, it's sort of like the shoot 'em ups we were talking about, in that these are both styles of game. Fighting games and shooting games are games that you progressively get better at over a period of years and decades, right? It's like a really long journey towards proficiency.
It is. And I think that's is sort of my gaming. If there was an epitaph for my gaming career, it would be that I always kind of chose games that were way above my pay grade in terms of my abilities as a gamer. But I kind of like that in a way. It's something to aspire to. It's something to sort of like, you know, dedicate your time to and see, as you say, incremental progress, but nevertheless progress. And definitely the feeling of beating your friends who could beat you previously, and then you practice, and then you absolutely thrash them. It's one of the best feelings in gaming.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, that feedback loop is really immediate in fighting games and shooting games, isn't it? And that with a shooting game, you just literally get a few meters further, don't you, up the screen. And with fighting games, yeah, it's like the person you couldn't beat yesterday, you can now beat just. And it's it's so satisfying, isn't it, that journey?
Exactly. And even with the online thing, like if you go from sort of winning one every five matches in whatever tier you're in to like winning three or four out of the five, then, you know, that is an enormous feeling of achievement. It's not really something that you can share with anyone else or get any badges for, or like, you know, it's just something that's good, that's for you. And, you know, that's what gaming is for me. It's like, it's something for me that is quite separate from my professional life as a musician. You know, it's something that's entirely mine. And even though there's been some crossover, you know, with the aforementioned Kojima thing, and, you know, we did a Mirror's Edge song as well, like it's always been kind of separate for me. It's like, don't touch this. This is mine.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, get back to Street Fighter 4. Like, again, you know, to the uninitiated, it's just two sort of avatars throwing punches at each other and knocking each other's health bar down. But as with the shmups, it's about the innovative systems that they put in each iteration of the game. And Street Fighter 4 had this great mechanic called focus, and you would hold down the medium kick and punch buttons, and either if you held it down and then released it, it would be a more powerful attack, or if you got hit while you were focusing, you would absorb the attack, and then you could or you could even cancel out of the focus by dashing. And so there was like a really flexible little system for like faking and like escaping tricky situations or causing some pretty big damage. And they took that out for Street Fighter V, but I always kind of mourn it. That's why I didn't choose Street Fighter V for my console choice, because there's just something about that flow and the way that it works and the way that it captured my imagination at the time as well. Yeah. It was just the perfect game for me.
Yeah, it was a big comeback as well for the series, because Street Fighter 3 had come out a decade earlier?
Yeah.
And there had not, or nearly a decade, and there had just not really been anything, and no proper attempt to make a big 3D game. And then it comes along and it was so exciting, wasn't it? And they'd absolutely nailed it. I remember that sort of period really fondly of the excitement around Street Fighter 4.
That's right, yeah. And also Street Fighter 3 kind of got a bad rep for being too kind of impenetrable for new players.
Yeah.
Because the system with the parry system, which was you had to kind of tap forward, I think,
To absorb an attack,
A hit. But the timing on that was so, the window was like, what was it, 2 or 3 frames? It was super, super tight.
Yeah.
And it was great to watch somebody who was good at it. You know, the famous video with Daigo and Justin Wong. It's great to watch, but to be able to pull off that is just way beyond.
Yeah, there's a tiny percentage of people that can perform at that level. Yeah,
absolutely. And Street Fighter 4 was something that brought it way more into the sort of mainstream and made it easier for sort of older players or newbies to sort of to dip into again.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And
so we talked a little bit at the start about you being in bands and all of that stuff in your 20s and joining Areogram. And, that had obviously been a dream for you to do that full time as your profession. And, you know, what kept you in that space? Because I suppose a lot of young people have that dream and then, when it gets really difficult, fall away from it. But you persisted. What'd you put that down to?
Areogram was, at the beginning of that band, there was a little bit of a buzz around the band. When we put out our first singles and then into the first album, there was a small but significant buzz around in the UK and in Germany and in America. We got signed to Matador in America, so we had the chance to go out and tour a bunch there, as well as in the continent in the UK. So that was, most people that I know who play in bands don't even get to that point where they get to tour America and travel and see that little bit of success. And I think maybe it was that. I think it was this is kind of achievable if you have the right songs and the right band and there's the right moment for that band. And almost 10 years of doing that, of touring and writing, that sort of touring, the writing touring cycle, it just became sort of my way of being. And when that band split up, I was like, oh, I'm done with bands for now. And then Craig, who was the singer and main songwriter in the band, he did a sneaky on me. He was like, I've got some songs. Can I come over and maybe record them? And, you know, and of course it gets to, oh, do you want to try a little thing here and a bit here? Before you know it, like, we're co-writing and co-producing an album. And that sort of took shape and became a new band that we called The Unwinding Hours. And so, yeah, when that was done, that was when Martin and I sort of finally got together that summer. I think it was summer of 2011. And the Moog, it was a Moog Voyager and a Juno 106 that I'd bought. And
had you not been into synths before then?
I mean, I couldn't really afford to get into sort of analog synths and stuff at the time.
Expensive game.
It's an expensive game. And we didn't make any money really at all with Aerogram. It was just, you know, like a couple of hundred quid here and there. And that was that was about it. But, you know, we were passionate about it. And that's kind of what drove us through the difficult times financially. I've always been into electronic music, and then I guess that summer 2011 that I really wanted to do a project that really had no bass and guitars, because that was, you know, mostly what I did in the other bands, and it was just purely electronic. And Martin Doherty was in a similar place at that time too, but he was listening to a lot more sort of pop music and sort of quite hipster electronic music and blog music at the time. We just got in the studio with no real rules and no real intentions other than let's see what happens. And and at the end of the first day, we had sort of two songs and sort of fired them over to Campbell, who was the bass player in Aerogram. He was like, oh my God, you guys need to really keep doing this. And he'd played it to a friend who was a DJ in Australia, one of the radio stations in Australia. And I think he walked by his room while he was listening to the demos and was like, what the hell is that? And so
holding the phone up.
It's like, what is this? And he became the manager of what was to become Churches once that sort of started to sort of come into its own.
So it's around this time, I guess, that the third game on your Perfect Console comes out, maybe slightly before, but I'm not sure when you were playing it. But anyway, do you want to tell us about it and how you got into it?
Yeah, well, the next game is Final Fantasy 14. So when did it come out? It was like 2010, I think, when the first version of it came out.
Yeah, which had loads of problems, didn't it?
Loads of problems. And eventually, I don't know how long it was running before they basically scrapped it and rewrote it and then released it as A Realm Reborn. I don't know when that was, but I didn't really get into it. I think it was 2017. And I was living in New York at the time, and I just had a sort of summer of nothing really in the calendar, which was really rare. I think we were sort of in a writing phase with the band, and we'd all sort of moved out to New York. Lauren had moved there first, and then I had moved there, and then Martin had moved there. So we were all in New York trying to make this record. And I finally decided to get into an MMO. I've always avoided, like, when the whole World of Warcraft thing was happening, you know, everybody was like, oh God, you have to play this game, you have to play it. And I just saw them losing their entire lives to this game.
Yeah.
They're such...
Very dangerous.
They're such massive time sinks, you know? And I was like, nope, I don't want to do that. So I kind of held off for the longest time, even trying an MMO. And that summer I was like, I think it was 2016, maybe been 2017. I was like, okay, I'm going to jump in. And I immediately just became completely consumed, as I thought, as I kind of hoped I might as well. And it was also kind of an escape. There was a lot going on in my head at the time as well. And, you know, I think that this is something I keep coming back to with video games. It's like, It's a real kind of escape. It's a way to sort of escape things that, you know, if you've got anxiety and depression and stuff like that, you can really absorb yourself into this sort of world. And it's such a fully, like Final Fantasy 14 in particular, is such a fully realized world. And the music is fantastic. The systems are so deep. The story is incredible. I mean, it tails off a little bit towards the end of the first sort of Realm Reborn campaign. I guess, you know, just trudging through these fetch quests eternally, but there's just so much to love about it, and I lost myself in it, and I continue to, like, I'll sort of drop in and out of it now, but I'm just about to start the last of the expansion packs, so I'm almost up to date. like 5 years later, and I think, I don't know, I must have about 600 hours or something on it. And it's probably nothing compared to people that, you know, that play it all the time. But for me, that's, you know, that's, that's quite a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I like what you say about the, particularly Final Fantasy XIV, A Realm Reborn. You've got all these little missions. And like you say, they are quite simple, like fetch things. Like a character says, look, you know, go and get some wood off like the carpenter on the other side of the village or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But like it takes, I don't know, 4 minutes, and then you get a da-da-da, and they're like, it gives you all of that lovely stuff. And it just breaks all of those problems in the world into really manageable chunks, and you could just get through like a to-do list really quickly.
Yeah.
And it feels so good, especially if like in your life outside of the game, you're wrestling with some big questions or whatever that just feels so unmanageable. Sometimes a game like that can just be, it can just calm you down and go, actually, like this, we can get through this, just got to break it down a bit.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I find as well, when you're doing kind of repetitive tasks like that, that aren't too, they don't require that much brain power or thought, you're processing things in the background. Yeah. You know, it's like a form of meditation. I find this as well, like I really like motorbikes. And that's something as well that I find, because you're so focused on one thing, you're super alert and super focused, especially on like a long ride, you know. It's not really a way to forget your life. It's a way to sort of process it without being sort of swallowed up by it, you know what I mean? Because you're so focused on this one task, and you get to the end of it and you're exhausted and you just want to lie down, but you feel like you've kind of gone through something.
Yeah, right, right.
And it is sort of like that with a bunch of the games that I like.
Yeah, you're putting all your like cognitive power onto one very narrow task, which allows, like you say, your subconscious to sort of get to work on the other bigger stuff in the background.
Yeah, and it's soothing. It's soothing as well. You know, it's like the music and the visuals, it's all very gentle and very, you know, there's no real time limit. But yeah, no, it's super soothing. And that's definitely something about, particularly Final Fantasy XIV with the music and the world. It's a beautiful world. And I love the character design and the interaction with other people, even though it is essential as part of a MMORPG. There's a lot that you do yourself in that game. And I think they're making it now where a lot of the dungeons, where all of the dungeons will, the story dungeons will eventually be populated with bots if you want. But I do think that there's something really nice about joining up with other people. Even, I mean, I don't really know that many people that play the game, but it's really fun, like being part of like a free company, which I guess is their
clans.
Was it like a clan or something like that? And you know, popping on, they're like, oh hey, how you doing, good evening, good morning, like how's it going, you know, just like gentle. There's no real expectations for that relationship. It's just like a check-in with these random people who like the same thing as you do.
It's nice.
I guess it's
very
nice.
Good.
It's nice.
So you as you say, you start churches, and it rapidly, like you say, you were coming to the fore at that period of the internet when blogs were a big thing. It was actually, I sort of really missed that time, but that was true in like games, but it was also true in music.
Yeah.
There were loads of like really powerful blogs which would be constantly finding great new things, and you really benefited from that, I think, didn't you? How did it feel becoming famous when you were like in your 30s, because I suppose you'd been you know, like, let's be honest, you're now like the kind of person that will get like a piece in the Daily Mail about who you're dating or something like that. It's that sort of, that's the world you operate in, like sorry if you didn't know that, but that's the kind of thing that happens, right? And you know, I suppose when you experience that, when you're in your early 20s, like some pop musicians do, that's one thing, but you'd had a lot more life experience. How did that feel, you know, getting all that stuff at that stage of your own journey?
I mean, I find it quite funny in a way. Martin and I'm quite a bit older than Martin. I think like 8 years older than Martin, something like that. Yeah, and he's like about seven, I can't remember, years older than Lauren. So there's this such bizarre sort of age spread in this band. And it's nice in a way because, you know, there is definitely an element of ageism in music, particularly, well, not all music, but in pop music particularly, you know. I mean, I don't really get recognised that much when I'm out and about. At the start of the band, yes, you know, people would shout, you know, churches or whatever, or they'd be like, are you the guy in churches? And it happens like very occasionally now, but I mean, it's really, I feel bad for Lauren because we sort of dragged her into this world. Unwittingly, we didn't know it was going to be as successful as it turned out to be, and neither did she, but she agreed to do it, and she often blames us, you know, she's like, you dragged me into this. And she, her life is very, very different, I think, in terms of the things that she can and can't do. And, you know, she has security in her home and stuff that I don't need to bother with because, I don't know, it's just a whole mess of, it's kind of fucked up, really, how celebrity, for want of a better term, affects your day-to-day life. And I guess I'm lucky to be a part of this and to be a musician in that space and not really have to deal with all of that shit. But I really feel for her because she's kind of the, you know, the young face of the band and the front person of the band, and she gets a lot of that unwanted attention. And we're there to support her as much as we can, but at the end of the day, it's on her shoulders, a lot of it, and that's kind of difficult to sit by and watch.
She wrote a great piece, didn't she, for The Guardian? This was probably 10 years ago now, but about like all of the misogyny she experiences, you know, is from, well, I guess from randoms on the internet as much as anyone, but that's got to be quite hard as her bandmate and friend to witness her going through that stuff.
It is, yeah. And as much as, like I said, we can sort of be there at her side and support her as much as we can, at the end of the day, it's directed at her a lot of the time. And it's very, very difficult to sit back and watch it. And sometimes, you know, sometimes I just want to say, just like delete all of your social media accounts and don't look at that shit because it's never going to change. But she cares so much about the people that do care about the band, and I don't know, having like some kind of connection with these people is really important to her, but one thing comes with the other, and I don't think that there's any real way of separating them unless you like employ somebody to like go through, like filter out all of the trash. You can, it's like you can find it anywhere you want to, even when you don't want to find it, it'll find you, and it's really quite disturbing, and I don't think it's something that you can ever really get used to as a human being, because you're just, you know, like anybody else, doing your job to the best of your abilities, and it comes with all this bullshit, this extra stuff that doesn't really make any sense. I think about it a lot, I suppose, and I think the people that do that, they just want to be seen, they just want to be close to something that's bigger than them or that's more successful than them, or to be a part of it, even if it's a negative part of it, it makes them feel validated in a way. And I'm not sure I'll ever really understand it, but I'm really, really lucky that I personally don't have to deal with a lot of that stuff, other than the occasional Daily Mail article, like you say.
Now that you've announced that you've got a third strike board in your house, you might need to up your security.
I sold it on eBay when I was skint years ago, sadly. I don't have it anymore. I wish I still had it, but... I don't know how much they're going for now. Do you have any insight on that?
Yeah, they've rocketed up because it's still popular, and it's really popular on the tournament scene. So yeah, to get the CPS3 board, it is, isn't it? I think now set you back £1,000 or something like that. So
That's like over 300. I think I got it for about 300 quid. The time. So that would have been,
you
like,
couldn't do that now.
2009, something like that. Yeah. Oh, well.
This has turned into the Antiques Roadshow, a little
bit.
Okay, let's. Why don't we come to your fourth game? Can you tell us about it?
Okay. So, yeah, my fourth game is Mario Kart 8 Deluxe. Another game that I discovered much earlier in the franchise, you know, along with Street Fighter. I think the Super Nintendo was the first version of Mario Kart, which I didn't really play that much, to be honest, until like much later on. But it was really when I got the GBA, the Game Boy Advance, and there was Mario Kart Super Circuit, I think, was a launch game for it, and I just became obsessed with it. We were making, I think it was like 2002-ish, 2000, yeah, and we, Aerogram, were making our second album, Sleep and Release, and that became the thing to do in between takes, was time trials, and it was, you know, I remember, you know, if Martin had to go and do a drum take, and I was sitting, you know, trying to beat his time on Peach Beach or whatever it was, and then he would come out and I would do a thing and he would have, and it would just go around the four of us, you know, just shaving like a tenth of a second off the last time and sort of learning the best lines and shortcuts. And so, yeah, every version of that game has become like a sort of time trial championship with my sort of friend group.
Oh, nice.
To the point now where there's like a WhatsApp group and there's like everybody from church, well, people from churches and the church's crew, people from Franz Ferdinand and like friends of mine. And there's like a big group of people now that there's on WhatsApp. So whenever there's a new like pack comes out, a track pack for Mario Kart, there's another whole time trial thing. And it's just like talking about falling into like a time-sucking vortex. Like, there's nothing like that game to just destroy your free time. But it's a great game to play on tour because, like, you know, you can just, the thing about being on tour is there's so much downtime, you know. In 24 hours, like, it's filled up with travel and, you know, interviews and sitting around and, you know, getting from one place to the next and sound checks and it's just, yeah, and then you're active for like 2 hours of the day and then that's it. So there's a ton of time to fill up. And so that's what we do. We'll choose like one track for 2 weeks and then everybody will like, and then you post a picture of, you know, your screen when you get your time and then the next, and then upload your ghost as well. That's a key component because like you can, your best time is saved as a ghost on the machine and then you can upload it to the server and you can see all of your friends' best times and then you go and download their ghost and you can race against their ghost. And it's just like an incremental, oh my God, I just beat your time. And then there's lots of smack talk and fun. It's a really, really fun game. And I choose Mario Kart 8 Deluxe here because I suppose in my head it's kind of the most complete version of Mario Kart. It's there's so many tracks now and they're just, they're in the process of releasing 3 or 4 new track packs throughout the year.
Coming up to Christmas, isn't it, this
year?
Yeah,
yeah, and they're absolutely brilliant. It's kind of like the greatest hits of Mario Kart, right from the Super Nintendo, every iteration of the game up till today, plus some new tracks. And again, it's like with what we were saying about Final Fantasy 14, it's like the colours and the world and the character design and there's just, and the music, it's just such a joyful kind of endorphin drip of happiness throughout. And I think it's, out of all of the games that I've chosen here, I think it's the only game that I'm kind of good at in these five. Not like, you know, top 10 in the world good, but
among,
you know,
that WhatsApp group.
Top, well, I think, you know, top few, like 1,000 or something like that in the world. So, you know,
That's definitely something.
Achievement.
I love it. So sort of like the arrangement you have with your friends and colleagues is, it's sort of like really contemporary, but also quite retro in a way. Like, it's old school. You're posting your scores, even though you're using all of this technology to do it. But yeah, it's amazing. Nice.
But I feel like that's what we're always trying to get back to, though, isn't it? Like, especially with fighting games and competitive gaming, like the feeling of being next to somebody at the same machine and kicking their arse or having yours kicked.
Yeah, yeah.
it's kind of what gaming's all about. It's like trying to get back to your teenage bedroom, I guess, when you had no cares in the world and, you know, everything that feeds into the nostalgia centers in your brain.
Absolutely. Yeah, no matter like who you are, whether it's video games or it's like, or vintage cars or whatever, or like toy railway sets, everyone's got their thing, haven't they? It reminds them of that time.
Yeah, and the middle-aged crisis thing as well, you know, midlife crisis, getting there.
So we talked right at the start about you working with Kojima. Can you just tell me how did they get in contact with you to ask you to write that piece? Was it something you'd already written that you gave them, or did they give you some directions on what they were after and all of that stuff?
No, we hadn't written it. He had asked us, we were going to be in Tokyo playing shows, and he'd asked us to come by the studio, and he would take us out for dinner. So we went and got sushi, And he showed us around the studio, which was, as we said earlier, a bit smaller at the time on a different floor in the Sony building, isn't it?
Next to it. Yeah, yeah.
Next to the Sony building. He just said he was a big fan of the band and asked us if we wanted to contribute something to his new game, Death Stranding. And he showed us, you know, he sat down with us in his studio and sort of played us through the first, or like a 45 minute section of the game and talked us through it. And it was, our minds were just blown because obviously nobody in the world had really seen this yet, other than maybe a launch trailer or something at the time. And it was fantastic to be at kind of, you know, his center of operations, getting shown this game. And He was just talking us through like the his sort of philosophy behind what the game meant to him as well, like being the idea of connectedness and sort of building bridges between people and who, and I guess it was kind of a reflection of his views on of an online world where people are sort of like to get together in a sense but separate, and I guess maybe politically as well, how you know, in this age people are kind of quite polarized and quite kind of tribalized, and how really what we need is someone to build these bridges to bring people together so that there's like a kind of discourse again where people can debate and I don't know, it's kind of part of a broader conversation, I guess, which we probably don't have time to get into, but that really touched us as well and struck a chord, and so we went away. He didn't really give us any direction at all. He was just like, go and write a song. Martin had come up with the initial demo and melody, and then I think we were on tour at the time, and we were sitting in we'd made a little back room at the back of the bus. We'd built a little studio with these tiny little Genelec monitors and our laptop and an interface, and him and I would sit up the back working on the arrangement, and yeah, I think we worked on it sort of on and off for 6 weeks or so, and then sort of once we got to a place where, and then Lauren sort of put the lyrics down, and we got to a place where we're like, this is good kind of bare bones demo of where we're at, what it's going to sound like. And we sent it. I mean, we were absolutely terrified when we sent it.
Had to give you homework.
You don't know. He's kind of reminded me, guys, this is shit. But no, he came back and he loved it. And he said it made him cry as well, which,
yeah.
I mean, it's quite an emotional song. I think from the construction of the melody to the lyrics, you know, it's a really, really hopeful and euphoric kind of message. Like, and that very much came from us actually sitting in the room with him and hearing him talk passionately about his idea for the game and, you know, where it's all coming from. So for him to come back with that and basically no notes whatsoever. So we just sort of finished the track up and got it done. And he was like, okay, so we're going to use this for the end credits of the game. And we're like, what?
So nice.
And that was, you know, that was a really beautiful moment because I, you know, grew up playing Metal Gear Solid and, you know, Silent Hill and really massive fan. Like, you know, every time he comes out with something new, we're like, what is this mad genius going to come up with next, you know? So to be a part of that is, I mean, we're just really lucky. Sometimes it doesn't even feel like it happened, like it's real, but...
Especially in that jet lag state of like meeting him and then composing in the back of the tour bus. It feels like a dream, I expect.
Yeah, I think that's the only state in which it sort of makes any sense. This, you know what I mean? It kind of feeds into the madness of this life of the last 10 years. It's just like... is this real? And I know that when it's all over, when we eventually decide that, you know, we're done with the band and we're going to move on with the rest of our lives, if and when that ever happens, we'll look back and go, that was a really trippy time. That was a trippy decade plus, you know. But it's been a lot of fun so far, and lots more to come, hopefully.
Yeah, I'm sure. Okay, let's come to your fifth and your final game. Can you tell us about it?
The last game I've chosen for my console is Tetris Effect. Again, like the other two that we've discussed, having a long lineage and history of playing that game. Yeah, I played it a little bit when it first came out when it came out on the Game Boy, as everybody did. But I never owned a Game Boy for some weird reason. I think I was kind of out of the way of being really into video games at the time, and I'd played it a bit, you know, on my friend's machine, but it didn't really sink its teeth in. But it wasn't until the DS version came out, and I think. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that was the first one to have like local multiplayer.
Oh gosh, possibly. Yeah, I couldn't say for certain.
I'll need to verify this one. But again, this was a tour. This was a tour game, and it was in the back of the van with Aerogram. And I think there was everybody at this point had a DS. I think there was like four or five DSs on the van, and I think you could connect like up to like six or something.
Yeah.
And competitive Tetris. Oh my God, that's a whole level of madness. And we just got so good at it, and it got really vicious. Played it obsessively. Yeah. Played it to death. That's a game that I wish I was like world class good at, because when you see these people who are like, you know, the world champion guys,
you can't even see what they're doing, can you? Yeah,
I know. And then there was the Grandmaster. There's a version by Rika, I think, the Tetris the Grandmaster 3, and I think when you complete the main part of the game, it goes into this kind of credits mode where you can't see the blocks that you've put down, so you're basically going on memory of all of the blocks that you've dropped, and these guys are dropping like 100 pieces per minute.
Oh my goodness.
And it's just like, how are you doing that with an arcade stick and two buttons or three buttons? Like, how is something, I mean, if you haven't seen this, you need to go and look it up.
Yeah, I'll pop on YouTube. There's loads of great videos there, yeah.
Pop it on YouTube. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, so anyway, so I chose this version because this is, I guess, in some ways, the most sort of complete version of modern Tetris, I guess, to make that distinction. Because people still play the old Nintendo one, NES one, competitively, don't they? I guess people would say that's like the purest form of Tetris.
Tetris Effect is like the art school version of Tetris, is this?
Yeah. But I guess all versions of modern Tetris have the sort of hold mechanic where, you know, for example, if you get a block that you can't use, you can put it on hold and then sort of keep that in the back of your mind to use when you need it. Hacks like me playing it probably always just hold the eye-shaped ones, because those are the ones that kind of get you out of jail if you're really in a bind.
But this is the game where so it's by Tetsuya Mizuguchi, isn't he, who made Res, and it's the first one where the music is really, I mean, Tetris music's always been important, but in this game it sort of elevates the whole experience, right?
Yeah, correct. So again, Mizuguchi's pretty famous for his sort of games that marry video game systems and music. So you're like with Res, every time you target a ship or an alien on the screen, there's like a sort of hi-hat sound. And if you sort of like, I think you can store up to 8 targets or something, and then when you release, like, it, there's like a flurry of hi-hats and like different explosions. And
it quantizes them all, doesn't it? So it's all in time with the music.
Exactly. So it feels, the idea is that it sort of feels like you're writing music as you play. And I guess the better you get at it, and this is true as well with the Tetris Effect, the better you get at it, the more Tetrises you get, the faster it gets, the more nuanced and complex the musical score becomes. And it's fantastic when you get into that zone and you're really nailing it. It's quite a unique marriage between all of those art forms that's really quite hard to describe. And it's especially good if you get a chance to play it in VR. And it's just like the whole world is kind of enveloping you, and you've got the headphones, and it's quite a trippy sensory overload experience, and it's just that it's a masterpiece. And then they did a version of it, Tetris Effect Connected, where you can now play multiplayer, and of course this, you know, it's just opens up the madness again. And again, like with Street Fighter, I was like, I'm getting really, really good at this, because I can, you know, you can see your sort of drops per minute coming up, and your lines per minute coming up, and the numbers sort of slowly creeping up when you get better at it. And then I played, my friend had it, who was like, oh, I haven't played Tetris in years, and you're probably going to kick my ass. And I was like, yeah, probably I am. Let's go. And then he schooled me, and I was like, what? Like, I thought I was getting good at this. And then, you know, and then you go back to sort of learning, you're back to school, sort of learning how to get faster and sort of more advanced techniques. The T-spin is still something I can't get my head around setting up. How do you explain the T-spin to the uninitiated?
So, so this is the block, which is 3 on the bottom and then 1 in the middle above it. Yeah, and as it's, the idea is if you've got like a little cavern hole in your Tetris wall,
right,
you can slide it in sideways, and then if you hit the button at the right time, it will click into place and fill the gap, but it's... Yeah, I know what you mean. It's a bit of a head mess.
Sometimes I turn
it the wrong way, and
Hard to set up. And if you can see the people who are really, really good at it, they have like a, you know, the screen is basically full to the top, except from this little sort of curving lane down the center, and that's where they sort of like tap the tee and sort of work his way all the way down to the bottom. And I'm saying, hey, how can you do that? But one of these days, maybe next one year, when, if I get my 1cc on Dodon Patch? Dodon Patch.
DDP.
DDP. If I get that this year, then next year is maybe my tee spin year. So I'll let you know.
Amazing. Right, so Ian, let's go through this. You've got your five picks are Dodon Patch, Daiuji, or DOJ, they call it in the community, don't they?
Thank you, yes.
Then Street Fighter 4, Final Fantasy 14, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, and Tetris Effect. That is a solid console, I reckon. Something for everyone on there. We need to give it a name to market it to the world. What should we call this one?
Coming up with names is the hardest thing, Simon. It's easy to come up with a name for that.
Name that is that's completely Googleable, even though it's a word everyone knows.
But you have no idea how difficult it was to come up with that name. Like, we deliberated for weeks and weeks and weeks to come up with churches.
What were some of the other options?
Oh my God, there were some horrendous ones.
Come on, let's go.
Well, the next sort of front runner after churches was, I think, Society. Which shit, isn't it? It's pretty shit.
Video 3 for the E at the end.
Oh, good. Video violence, screen violence. Screen violence was actually that we ended up revisiting for our fourth Churches album. And there was one of the worst ones I think we came up with. It was Lauren's idea. Sorry, Lauren. Was it Lovely Owl? I'm pretty sure that we wouldn't be sitting here talking about a decade plus career in music if that was
sounds, in there. That sounds like a hit iPhone game. Lovely Owl. It's all the rage.
Yeah, totally. Flappy Owl. But we eventually ended up having to lock ourselves in a room and vow not to leave the room until we had come up with a name. And it was like 3 a.m. and we put our sort of top picks into a hat or something, and then we're like, right, whatever we pull out here, it's going to be that. And we pulled it out and we're like, no, that's terrible. And then eventually Churches, but it was Churches with a U like first. And of course, as you've already intimated, it's not a very Googleable name because we come up with, you know, Churches, I think. And then we thought, okay, I think somebody, our friend Amy, who is a friend of Campbell, our manager's, was coming up with a logo for the band and had sort of stylized the U as a V, and we thought it looked cool, and we thought, oh, why don't we just roll with it? But anyway, that's an aside to your difficult question about the name of my perfect console.
So should we call it Lovely Owl?
Lovely Owl. I was thinking of when you asked me this the other day, I was like, I don't know. So I decided to name it after one of my pets. I've got a cat called Pickle, and I'm going to call it Pickle Vision 5000.
Yes, I love it. So many people have put like a 5000 at the end, even though I don't know any game consoles that have done that for 5,000. A really long time.
Well, I love it. You could do 2600. So that might be nice.
Yeah. Very good. Okay, Pickle Vision 5000. Brilliant. Right, I've just got one last question. I'll let you go because you've been really generous, and I know you're tired. But
so good. This has woken me up. This is great.
So I saw this is a question I thought, because I went to a gig the other day and I was wondering about this. So I saw actually a video of like Prince's first ever gig he did when he played Purple Rain. So it was like, I don't know, 1983 or something. It's a really good video. You can could look it up on YouTube, but he's playing at First Avenue, and man, it's just so exciting. And there's something in the performance that he gives where you think, oh, he's like doing this for the first time, he's really excited to play this song to the crowd. It's like super electric. And I was thinking, when you're like a touring band and you're on date 26, how do you you've played the song so many times, like how do you keep that excitement? Do you have to? Do you think that ever comes across to the audience, or does it always feel like the first time, or is it sometimes just doing a job?
That's a really great question. And I think about this a lot. I think, yes, you can. You can absolutely phone it in because you've done it. I mean, if I think about, you know, The Mother We Share, which is probably the most identifiable of the songs that we've written, and we must have played it, well over 1,000 times now. But it doesn't, and yes, it's muscle memory, of course. You know, I could do it in my sleep, and I'm sure that the same is true for my band members. But there's something really it just doesn't feel right. Like, I think you have to get yourself into a place when you perform where you're giving some energy to the audience, and I think it's really reciprocal, because I think if you're having an off night and you're just like, oh God, I'm so hungry, or I want to go to bed, or like I'm tired, I'm hungover or jet lagged or whatever, I think you can really feel that, the absence of sort of reciprocal energy from the crowd. And I do think that every single time it's worth giving of yourself, whatever that costs, whatever that takes, in order to feel that sort of flow of energy. And man, that never gets old. It just doesn't, you know? It's different for it's different in a festival, it's different in a small venue or like a theatre or an arena, like it, just like, and it's different in every part of the world, you know? Every crowd brings its own completely different energy, and it's really one of the joys of doing what we do, and it always keeps it interesting, and I don't know how, but it does, I'm glad to say.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I mean, I sometimes feel that with writing as well. You learn the mechanics of like writing a story, and then, but you have to put some skin in the game. You have to put some of your, you know, you've got to put something in it. And that does somehow come across in this mystical way.
Yeah.
When you're making things.
Totally, totally. Yeah, and it's also like, you and I both are in really privileged positions in that regard, you know, to be able to have that platform for our voices or for our spirits or whatever it is we do creatively. It's a wonderfully privileged position to be in. And so, yeah, it's good to be mindful of not taking that for granted at any point, you know?
Yeah.
And it does give in return in many ways, you know? It gives back.
Ian, this has been so good. Thank you so much for coming on and chatting to me, and yeah, it's been great.
Thanks for inviting me. I'd obviously do a lot of interviews around music, but I would happily talk about video games all day, every day. So it's been a joy. Thank you very much, Simon.
Ian Cook. Everyone, what a marvellous human being. How wonderful to hear his five excellent choices for his console. I still think it should maybe be called Lovely Al, but we'll go with his pick for now. I particularly just enjoyed hearing about what role, what place video games play for him, the space they occupy in his life, a little bit of a retreat perhaps from the storm that is his life day to day at the moment, while he's in this, you know, world famous band for however long that lasts. I'm sure it'll last for a long time. I'm not suggesting anything with that, but I just mean, isn't it interesting that games can offer him that little site of refuge to spend some time in while everything else is going on all around. I don't think Ian is on social media, so you can't follow him, but you can, of course, listen to his band's music, not only Churches, but the other bands he's been in that we talked about. And like you said, you can follow his bandmates. Lauren as well is on Twitter, I think. If you do follow her, don't be a jerk. I think that came across in that section of the interview. I guess celebrity has this sort of warping effect on us, doesn't it? But it's just people trying to make their way, trying to do the best work that they can. You can follow me on Twitter at Simon Parkin, although as I'm recording this, I'm currently locked out because someone tried to hack into my account last night. So hopefully I'll get that restored shortly. But you can definitely follow My Perfect Console, the podcast, My Perfect Console with the O's removed from console, where you can get previews of who the next guest will be every Friday. I do a little clip for the guest the following week. You can also become an early access subscriber to the podcast for just £3 a month, or $3 or €3, wherever you are. Less than the cost of a cup of coffee, all that stuff. You can support the podcast, you'll get ad-free episodes, and you also get the chance to download them 24 hours before the general public, and you get your own special podcast icon for it as well. I know, what a bargain. Only remains for me to say, next week I'll be back with one more guest, their five games,
and one more perfect console. Until then, have a wonderful week. Goodbye.
Of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.